cover the whole 18 chapters, but I thought it would be better to deal with the first chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, because there would be foundation of Krishna consciousness. So we're trying to cover as many of the first chapters as possible. The first time I saw the Bhagavad Gita in 1968, I was going to the University of Buffalo. At that time, there was one devotee named Rupanuga, and he was giving classes there on the Bhagavad Gita at the university on the lawn. And there was one devotee who was a friend of my friend, who we knew. His name was Burjan. And Rupanuga would give the Bhagavad Gita class outside, and Burjan Prabhu would give the Bhagavad Gita class twice a week inside, because he was the eldest devotee, because he was already living in the temple for a month. We respected him as a senior devotee. So twice a week I'd go and listen. Unfortunately, they only had a Xerox copy of Dr. Radhakrishna's, the vice president of India, his Bhagavad Gita, the one that Prabhupada always criticized. And they only had the second chapter. And the only verse in a month he'd read, twice a week he'd read the same verse. Denosminita dehe komaram yovanam dura kita dehantara praptira diras tatranamuyati. So I sat there, and then Rupanuga Prabhu would read similar verse, three times a week at the university. So I'd sit there more or less 5 days a week, it was on my free time, listening to Denosminita dehe. So after a month I thought, don't they know anything else? But I sat there, and then by the end of the month, I thought, wow, that's fantastic. I'm not my body. I said, this is a fantastic verse. And then right when I was moving into the temple, the little blue Bhagavad Gita came out, the Macmillan one, which was quite condensed. And as soon as I got it, I read it in one day, the Bhagavad Gita, and then I decided I'd start memorizing it. And I made a vow I wouldn't talk about anything except the Bhagavad Gita. So people would ask me a question, and I'd quote a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. So people realized it was a little unusual. But I was determined. And then later on, of course, at one time I was the president of a temple in Texas. And another temple president at that time was Ridhananda Maharaj. I was the temple president of Austin. He was the temple president of Houston. This is in 1972. And Ridhananda Maharaj, whenever I go and visit him, he was always in the attic of the temple, reading Prabhupada's books. At that time, the movement wasn't so clear whether it was a bona fide activity or not. It was one of the processes of devotional service. I remember one time when I first joined, I started to read one of Prabhupada's books, and my roommate, formerly, who was a friend before I joined, he caught me reading one of Prabhupada's books. And he started to chastise me. And so I had to stay up at night. And Rupanuga, one time he caught me, the temple president, he caught me reading the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And he told me I couldn't read it. So it was like, sometimes when children, they want to read some book, but their parents don't want to want them to read that book. They have to sneak around. So I'd have to stay up late at night when everyone took rest to read the books. Because I got a little strange. From that book, I got some strange ideas. In any case, in 1970, I went to visit Ridhananda Maharaj. He had just taken sannyas with His Holiness Satsarup Maharaj. And the first Bhagavad Gita, which had Sanskrit in it, had come out. And Ridhananda Maharaj had a copy of it. And he started to quote the verse, Imam Vishate Yogam Praktivanaham Aviyam. So I heard the Sanskrit from the verse, and I thought, wow, he's a great scholar. He actually knew a couple of verses in Sanskrit. I was amazed. So I thought, when I get the opportunity, I'm also going to try and learn the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit. And I get one of these rare copies of the Bhagavad Gita written in the original language, 5,000-year-old script. And then later on, Ridhananda Maharaj, he used to spend, when I visited, he was traveling as a preacher, in Arizona one time and met him with my traveling party when I was in Radhadamodar. And he was spending the whole morning reciting the Bhagavad Gita. So I thought this was something to do, was to learn the whole Bhagavad Gita. And I asked him whether he understood, because all he would do is read the Sanskrit. I asked him if he knew what was being said when he quoted. He said, yes. So I thought I should learn it. And then, a couple of years later, I got the service of distributing records in an airport, which was not the service I was looking forward to doing at that time. It was, I forget the name of the record. What was the name of the record by Michael Cassidy, the first one? No, something about Change of Heart. Right, I used to go to sleep hearing that record, Change of Heart, because all day long I'd be distributing it. It was an unusual period. But then I had time because the planes would come in and everyone would pass by, all the soldiers. It was an army base, missile base, actually. So all the soldiers would go by real quick. And then I have a couple of hours, so I spent a couple of hours learning the Bhagavad Gita. So by the end of my stay there, I had learned the Bhagavad Gita. So that's what I, besides Change of Heart, I was hearing Krishna sometimes talking the Bhagavad Gita. In any case, some years went by and I forgot everything, or nearly everything. And then Krishna gave me another service. One devotee, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, asked me to go and help another sannyasi in the Philippines. So I went there, and it was that other devotee had left there. I had gone there to help. And the Philippines, it was during the monsoon rain season. So during the 4 months of the monsoon rain season, during Chaturmasya, I got a chance to memorize the Bhagavad Gita again. And then after some years, I forgot the whole thing. Now I memorized most of it again. So I'm inspired to give the Bhagavad Gita seminar. Prabhupada found the Bhagavad Gita very exciting, because even during Prabhupada's last days, when sometimes it appears that he was sleeping, when Prabhupada was sick in India, sometimes he'd take rest and he'd chant a verse of the Bhagavad Gita, and then when he'd wake up, he'd be chanting the same verse from the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, he was during his whole time, hours and hours, he would be meditating on that verses from the Bhagavad Gita. So these are not ordinary verses. At the end of the Bhagavad Gita, our Sanjaya, he says that by repeatedly remembering the Bhagavad Gita, I'm becoming more and more filled with transcendental happiness. And remembering again and again Lord Krishna and Arjuna, hearing and speaking the Bhagavad Gita, I'm becoming overwhelmed with transcendental happiness. That's the actual hearing of the Bhagavad Gita. The unfortunate thing is sometimes we think that we've transcended the Bhagavad Gita, that I've been a devotee, I've learned the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, that I know so many slokas, or I've heard them so many different times, I already know them. But factually, if one could just hear once one of the slokas of the Bhagavad Gita and hear it with rapt attention, one would meet Krishna face to face, because there's no difference between the Bhagavad Gita and Lord Krishna. And the Bhagavad Gita, not only is it non-different from Krishna, but it is our basic preaching. Prabhupada once told the devotees that the Bhagavad Gita is our basic preaching book. If we want to know what and how to preach to others, we should know the Bhagavad Gita, as he said, Srila Prabhupada, just like a lawyer knows his law book. And there's no limit to how well we can know the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, I'll try to explain a little bit, but this is just a little bit of an introduction to the Bhagavad Gita overview. And hopefully this will inspire all of us to hear and try to understand more and more about the Bhagavad Gita and try to enter into it in a practical way. The Bhagavad Gita has 18 different chapters, Of course, the Bhagavad Gita, 18 is a significant number in the Vedic literature, also in numerology, which comes from the Vedas, because 8 plus 1 is equal to 9, which is the highest single number you can have. And undoubtedly that was taken into consideration, because I don't think when Krishna was speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, he said, "My dear Arjuna, this is now the first chapter. And now we've come to the second chapter. We'll call it Contents of the Gita Summarized." And Arjuna said, "Well, can you go over the first chapter? I think I missed verse 46. But 18 chapters was the number, because I don't, somehow or another it was arranged that way by Śrīla Vyāsadeva. But there are, 18 is a very auspicious number. There are 18 Akshahini divisions of soldiers fighting the Battle of Kurukshetra. The battle took 18 days. There are 18 Puranas. Therefore, it's not by accident there are 18 different chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it's divided into three different parts. Does there anyone here know, how many devotees know all the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, their names? That's because Shivananda gave the Bhagavad Gita overview class. That's why he knows. But otherwise, isn't that right? Just by knowing the 18 names of the chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, it's enlightening. But there are 18, they're divided into three different sections. The first section is called, we could call it Karma Yoga. But basically, it's the explanation of how to arrive at the position where we can appreciate devotional service. Basically, he talks about Gyan and Vairagya with an emphasis upon karma. Karma, which helps us come to the platform, or Karma Yoga, come to the platform of knowledge and renunciation. It's like setting the soil or plowing the soil and making it fertile, so that when the seed is planted of this next six chapters, then the flower, the planted devotional service, culminating the flower of bhakti or prema, is able to be planted in fertile ground. The middle six chapters is from the chapter called Knowledge of the Absolute up until the end of this, the 12th chapter, devotional service, explains about pure devotional service, which is what Krishna is really talking about throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita. But the emphasis on pure devotional service is in the middle six chapters. And in the last six chapters, beginning with nature, the enjoyer, and consciousness, to the renunciation of the 18th chapter, and the conclusion, the perfection of renunciation, deals with the essential knowledge that's necessary to keep us fixed in pure devotional service. Bhagavad Gita, of course, is just like a bowl of sugar. Wherever we enter into it, it is always going to be sweet. But Prabhupada also liked us at the beginning. Also, we should understand that the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's mercy to the conditioned souls. The Mahabharata, which is said to be meant for Sri Sudra Dvija Bandhunam, for women, Shudras, and the friends of the twice born, which any of us would be happy to have such qualifications in Kali Yuga to fit into, that the Bhagavad Gita, or the Mahabharata, which was spoken to the sun god by Shukadeva Goswami and contains 1,200,000 verses. It's a lot of verses, actually. The Srimad Bhagavatam contains, in the verses, 18,000. So we can imagine how long it would take to hear 1,200,000 verses. Of course, if Shukadeva Goswami was speaking, we'd probably be happy to hear it. But the whole Mahabharata is all meant to culminate in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna has arranged the Pandavas, and there are different trials and tribulations throughout the whole Mahabharata, with their Yudhisthira Maharaj being cheated of his kingdom, the Pandavas being exiled into the forest, Bhima battling against Hindimba, Rakshasas, their house being set on fire. So many trials and tribulations, plus all the different stories of Indra and Chandra and all the sages, Vashista. So many wonderful stories in the Mahabharata, and they're all meant to bring us up to the battle of Kurukshetra. When Prabhupada said in the original Bhagavad Gita, there were 640 million soldiers arraigned, about to fight and kill each other in a huge battle. So you can just imagine how exciting it would be if you read in the newspapers that a battle was going to go on, you know, the good guys, whoever you think the good guys are nowadays, and the bad guys. And there's going to be a huge fight, and it's all going to be on television. Cable TV. How many people would tune in to the fight? Even the Ramayana, when I was in India one time, they were showing the Ramayana on television, that everything stopped in India. The trains stopped, the buses stopped, everything stopped, and everyone, 840 million people, sat before their television to watch the Ramayana and also the Mahabharata. Actually, it was the Mahabharata. So if this is just the movie, imagine if the real thing was going on. So Krishna arranged everything, and people did come. People, there were actually spectators at the Battle of Kurukshetra. They were watching the fight. But here, we get a chance to hear this wonderful pastimes all culminating in this huge war that's going to take place. And it's not some tanks and, you know, artillery and machine guns. It's Brahmastas and Agni weapons and all kinds of fire weapons and water weapons and earth weapons and wind weapons. Someone would throw a hurricane and someone else would throw a mountain. Really exciting battle. And it's all meant to bring us to this point where we can hear Krishna speaking to Arjuna about the Bhagavad Gita. That's the whole purpose of the Mahabharata, practically speaking, is just so we can hear directly from Krishna speaking to Arjuna, who's asking the questions that we should ask if we were present with Krishna. And in this way, we can get clear direction how to make our lives successful, this human form of life, especially in Kali Yuga. So I'll briefly explain about what the 18th chapter is on, and then we'll start with the first chapter. Sometimes when we hear about the first chapter or the devotees read the first chapter, I know when I distribute the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes in the airport, people get they get the Bhagavad Gita and they start, even in the airport. You know, and they open it up and it's Dhritarashtravacha, Dharma Kshetre, Kuru Kshetre, Samaveda Yutsavaha, Mamakam Pandivais Shaiva Kimakurvata Sanjaya. And you go, what is this? Dhritarashtra, I can't even pronounce the name. He's speaking to Sanjaya and something about Kurukshetra and Dharmakshetra and Dristaketu, Chaikitana, Kasirajas, Travirya. Phew. Then they sit down and they think, well, do you have another book? Maybe have the bridge version, I think. Sometimes we go through that. We think, well, even I've seen devotees, they want to read the Bhagavad Gita, they'll have Bhagavad Gita class, and they'll start on the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita because they want to avoid the first one. They don't think there's that much information. But I think we'll find, if we go through the first chapter, there's quite a bit of information in it. The first Bhagavad Gita class I ever gave was when they had just moved to 61 Second Avenue from 26 Second Avenue. And they gave me the first, it wasn't the first, it was the second or third verse from the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And I thought, wow, I got to have to give class on this? And somehow or another Krishna let me say something. But it's actually quite an amazing chapter. Briefly, I'll review now the 18th chapters from the Bhagavad Gita. The first chapter sets the scene. It's called Observing the Armies in the Battle of Kurukshetra. Arjuna asks or he doesn't ask. He tells Krishna many reasons why he doesn't want to fight. And most of them are quite shastric. They come from Dharma Shastra and from Dharma Shastra meant for the Brahmins and also from the Shastra meant for the Kshatriyas, Artha Shastra. And it seems like Arjuna, presenting his case, has very reasonable arguments why he shouldn't fight. But in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, after hearing these arguments, and after Arjuna becomes bewildered after hearing himself talk, it's just like if you're out there preaching to someone, and after hearing yourself preaching, you become convinced that you shouldn't do whatever you tell them to do. So Arjuna, after preaching to Krishna, telling him why he didn't want to fight, he becomes so bewildered, he surrenders. And then Krishna, he begins to speak the Bhagavad Gita. And in the second chapter, he gives a very quick overview of the whole contents of the Bhagavad Gita, explaining essentially about karma and about jnana and something about bhakti. And then something called Nishkam Karma Yoga, which Prabhupada translates as Buddhi Yoga, which is what Krishna wanted Arjuna to do. And so we'll explain about that when we get to that. And then at the end of the chapter, Krishna says that if you become fixed in this knowledge, then even at the time of death, you can enter into the kingdom of God. Therefore, we can understand the purpose of our performing Krishna conscious activities, the purpose of our doing devotional service, the purpose of hearing the Bhagavad Gita to know what to do, is that eventually we'll become qualified to enter into the kingdom of God. That's what we're supposed to be doing, is entering into the kingdom of God. Sometimes devotees, they think, well, Prabhupada said, or Lord Chaitanya said, Mama Janmani Janmani Shre Bhavatad Bhakti Ahaitu Ki Twami, that I don't even want to go back, I don't even want liberation. So we think, well, he doesn't want liberation. Why should I want liberation? Who cares if I come back to the material world, birth after birth? So it's a fact, we don't care if we come back birth after birth, but Lord Chaitanya says, Ahaituki Bhakti, what he really wants is causeless devotional service. And if one has causeless devotional service, then even if he comes back to the material world, he's not in the material world. He's in the kingdom of God. It doesn't mean he has to go to Goloka Vrindavan to be in the kingdom of God. He can come back and take another birth and still be in the kingdom of God. We should understand ourselves that we're supposed to go to the kingdom of God even in this lifetime. And that at the end of this lifetime, we should remain in the kingdom of God even at the time of changing our body. And if Krishna wants us to come back to the material world, that's up to him. Or if he sends us to the planets where the devotees get trained up to go back to Goloka Vrindavan, that's up to him. But the devotee who's fixed in Krishna consciousness and devotional service, he's already attained to the kingdom of God, and it doesn't really matter whether he takes birth again or not. But Arjuna, he couldn't understand what Krishna was talking about. Therefore, Krishna begins at the beginning in the third chapter called Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is the gradual process of developing a faith in the Vedic literature so that one day one could understand what the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita or the Vedic literature is. And it begins with what's called karma, performing sacrifice. Different types of sacrifice. One is called karma kanda, meaning that I perform a sacrifice in order to get some material benefit. And there are different types of material benefits one can obtain. But by doing that, one develops faith, and by developing faith gradually, one comes to the position where one can appreciate that the whole purpose of performing these sacrifices is to become detached from the material world and to realize the importance of transcendental knowledge, jnana and vairagya. Then in the fourth chapter called Transcendental Knowledge, Krishna explains about different types of transcendental knowledge. Especially he begins to explain about transcendental knowledge about himself and the process of receiving transcendental knowledge. Then he explains about all different types of Vedic sacrifices, and then he says that all these sacrifices, they culminate in transcendental knowledge. Then in the fifth chapter called Karma Yoga, Action in Krishna Consciousness, the experience of one who's worked in transcendental knowledge, what his experience is even within the body, the mystic experience of a transcendentalist. It's like people sometimes, they, during meetings, especially religious meetings, people stand up and they give their testimony. They witness, they say, sometimes it's called witnessing. So they give their test. So this fifth chapter is the testimony experience of a person in transcendental knowledge. And then the sixth chapter, Krishna takes it one step further, and not only knowledge of that we're not this body, liberation, but knowledge of the transcendentalist who's situated in the realization of the super soul, who's seeing Paramatma within his heart. So Brahman, Paramatma, and then we're ready for, in the beginning of the seventh chapter, knowledge about Bhagavan. So the seventh chapter explains about Krishna and how to see not only the Brahman, Paramatma, but how Krishna is Bhagavan. He's the all-pervading person. Everything that we see around us is his energies. And Krishna talks about those persons who are qualified to see Krishna and to take the devotional service, and those persons who are disqualified. And then at the end he explains the person who's qualified to see him everywhere, and Arjuna asks about all the different terms. Sati Bhuta Didaivamam Sati Jagnat Yevidu Priyana Kali Pichamam Tevidur Yukta Chetasa. And the eighth chapter deals with all the different terms, and Krishna explains what is karma, what is sacrifice, what is the living entity, what is the material nature, etc. And especially Krishna talks about how one can know him at the time of death. Bhagavad Gita has a lot to do with that. I was looking at the, when I memorized the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, I was amazed how many times Krishna talks about time and death. Mrityu sava haras chaham kala smi bharatar kala kaliyatam jaham. Krishna says, I am death, I am the destroyer of all things. Or mrityu sava haras chaham, I come as death and I take everything away. I am time, Krishna says, who destroys everything. Kala, three or four times in the 10th chapter. So, 8th chapter, Krishna talks about how to remain fixed in Krishna consciousness even at death. And then in the 9th chapter, the nature of pure devotional service is described. Especially the very middle of the Bhagavad Gita is the most important verse. Bhagavad Gita, Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Madhyaji Mam Namaskuru Mamai Vaishasi Yuktaivam Atmaram Matparayanaha. It always engage your mind in thinking of me, engage your body in my service, worship me, surrender to me. The result is that you'll come to me. And Krishna repeats that again in the 18th chapter. And also verses such as Patram, Pushpam, Palam Toyam, Yome Bhakta Priyachati. So Krishna emphasizes loving service to Krishna in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then after explaining this, then Krishna explains that why should one serve him? In other words, everyone seems just like Krishna says, Manma, think of me. But everyone thinks like that. That's what everyone wants. Your mother wants to find out when you go home, have you been thinking of me? Why didn't you write me a letter? Become my servant. What did I have children for anyhow? So everyone's thinking like that. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me. And even there are commentaries by the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, and they say, yeah, it's Krishna, he's saying, think of him, but he's just like, he's just representing us. But then we have to read the 10th chapter, and in the 10th chapter, Krishna explains why we should think of him, because aham savasya pravavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam bhuta bhava samanvitaha. Because he's the source of everything. For everything is coming from him, and those who understand that factually, they develop bhava, or they can worship Krishna with all their heart. And then Krishna explains all these different manifestations. Aham adhya hide, aham, he says, vedaham, vedanam sama vedosmi, devanam an, vasavaha, bhutanam asmi chaitana, indriyanam manaschasmi, bhutanam asmi chaitana. That vedanam of the Vedas, I am the sama veda, of the demigods, I am Indra, of the living beings, I am the living force, and of the senses, I am the mind. And he said, aham atma gurukesha sarvabhuta shayastita aham adhishtamajam cha bhutanam anta eva cha. I am the self, O Arjuna, dwelling in the hearts of all beings. I am the beginning and the middle of the end of all creations. So Krishna begins to explain all these amazing things. He's the Himalayas, he's the light in the sun, he's the light in the moon, he's Arjuna, he's the Indra, he's the shark, he's the so many different amazing things. He's the letter A, Aksharam, Aksharanam Akarosmi. And this way, when we see different things, we can remember Krishna. If you look up in the sky and you see the moon, you think that Krishna is the moon. If you see, for instance, in this room, what can we think of? What's, of course, here, the only thing about spring, we can see the flowers. He says, I am Ritunam Kusamakaraha, I am flower-bearing spring. At least the flowers are here. That way we can remember Krishna. Because here Krishna says, I'm Gornitai. But I'm the self dwelling in the hearts of all beings. Whenever I see green, sometimes I think Krishna says, of all wielders of weapons, I am Ram. So if we see green and we remember Ram, then we can remember that all the wielders of weapons. And after hearing the 10th chapter, Krishna says, after speaking it, he says, Ataiva bhavanai tena, kim gyatena to Arjuna, vishtavyahamidam krishnam ekam shena stito jagat. Of all these mighty, glorious creations, they spring from but a spark of my splendor. And then in the 11th chapter, Krishna, he's spoken about, he's everything, and it sounds like he's quite, you know, he's just speaking so many words and so many, just like his Guru Maharaji, he came along. He also said he was Bhagavan. But then in the 11th chapter, Krishna displays his universal form to Arjuna, just so that we can get some idea of what it would be like to actually see who God is, what he can actually do. So he not only speaks, in the 10th chapter, he displays his universal form in the 11th. And then, people may mistake, oh, Krishna, the universal form is actually quite important. So then Krishna explains the 12th chapter to give us some idea of what the different levels of devotional service are. And in the 13th chapter, Krishna explains how it begins jnana, or knowledge, how the living entity is trapped in the material world, just like in a prison. And how he's completely strapped, he's completely bound by this body, trapped in the body, imagining himself to be the doer of all his activities, thinking himself responsible for so many, for becoming the controller and the enjoyer of the material nature, that by some plan of his he'll be able to do it. But then it's explained how he's completely helpless. He can't do anything. All he's doing is desiring, and as long as he's not Krishna conscious, he's simply creating one prison after another. But he can get out of it by transcendental knowledge. And then in the 14th chapter, that transcendental knowledge is explained in a different way. Krishna says, Param Bhuya Pravakshami Jnanam Jnana Uttama Yaj Gyatvamunaya Sarve Param Siddhim Ito Gata. Now I'll explain to you the best of all knowledge, even better than I've explained so far. So does that mean that this is better than the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita? No, but he's explaining in a way that most people can relate to. Therefore it's better. The same knowledge, but explained in a way that people can take advantage of in general. So he talks about the three modes and how by understanding that, the three modes of nature and devotional, and in relationship to devotional service, then with this knowledge we can get out of the three modes and become liberated by the process of devotional service. And the 15th chapter, then Krishna explains about Purushottama Yoga, how the living entity is transmigrating. But if he takes shelter of Krishna, who can help him, who's so many different things, who's a maintainer of the living entity, then he can become liberated. And those who don't become liberated, who want to remain in the material world to enjoy, their qualities are explained in the 16th chapter, the Divine Endymion. And the 17th chapter, Krishna says, all these different sacrifices, whatever you're doing, the whole purpose is just become fixed in Krishna consciousness and devotional service. And then Krishna goes through the whole thing in the 18th chapter, summarizes everything, and finally we get to two verses, and we find out, Krishna says, Sarva Dharma Parityaja Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. Now I've explained to you the whole, we spent 2 hours or so here in the Bhagavad Gita, so just forget about everything I've told you in the last 2 hours. And just surrender to me. And that's all you have to do and everything's alright. So after hearing the whole Bhagavad Gita, we find out that supposedly we didn't have to hear it, going to Krishna. But if we can just accept to surrender to Krishna, then everything's alright. Of course, it's not so easy to accept those last verses. Therefore, it is worthwhile to hear the first 18 chapters of Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna's destroying our doubts by hearing this knowledge with transcendental knowledge so that we have no more doubts who we are, what our purpose of life is, how to fulfill or achieve that purpose of life just by hearing the Bhagavad Gita. So now let's start with the... What time do I have until? Oh, okay. Is that right? 11, all right. So those who have Bhagavad Gita, we can chant together. Tam tada Dhritarashtra vacha dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveda yutsavaha mamekam banavaischaiva kim akuravata sanjaya. Dhritarashtra said, O Sanjaya, after looking over the military phalanx, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do? Bhagavad Gita begins with a question, and Dhritarashtra, he's speaking to Sanjaya. Sanjaya has left the battlefield, and he has transcendental vision given to him by his spiritual master, Srila Vyasadeva. And he's relating to Dhritarashtra, the blind king, who's blind materially and spiritually. So this is very appropriate because according to this age, this is the age of blindness. Andaya tandera upagiyamanas te pisha tantra rudami bada. And also it says that Srila Vyasadeva, he compiled the Vedic literature because people in this age, they've lost their vision due to the dense darkness of Kali Yuga. Is that what is the Sanskrit for that? Yes, Krishna's Vidharma Pagavate Dharma Pagavate Jnana Dharma Tubi Saha Kalo Nashta Drisham Esha Puranako Dunoditaha. So the Puranas were compiled because people are blind in this age, and therefore to get light, Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Puranas in the form of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But also, Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna because we're blind the people in general are blind like Dhritarashtra. Neither they have material vision nor do they have spiritual vision. And therefore, just as the Dhritarashtra's sons were all destroyed, so similarly, people in general, they're going towards the darkest regions of ignorance. Dhritarashtra, he's worried because this battle is about to be fought at Dharma Kshetra. Dharma, of course, means religion. And Dhritarashtra's sons were irreligious, headed by Duryodhana. As well as the fact that their mission was also irreligious. Yudhisthira Maharaj was the personification of virtue. He was the personification of all good godly qualities. And yet, Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana, they were simply envious. No other word. They were just burned. All their activities in trying to defeat the Pandavas and destroy them was all simply due to envy. Even Krishna went to speak to Dhritarashtra and the assembly, but because they were so envious, they couldn't hear anything he was saying. Duryodhana was compared to a snake. Therefore, Dhritarashtra is quite concerned. What will happen to my sons now that they're about to fight on a holy place like Dharmakshetra or Kurukshetra? Surely it's very inauspicious for them. For the demons, a holy place is very inauspicious. And a very demonic place is very auspicious. The demons never tell their friends, hey, why don't we meet at the temple? Go for some lassi at the temple. And the devotees, they never say, hey, why don't we meet at the bar? So that's the difference between the demons and the devotees. The Dhritarashtra is thinking that this is not a very auspicious place to have a fight. And at the same time, he was hoping that this battle, that this Dharmakshetra was such that maybe Yudhisthira and the Pandavas would be influenced in such a way as they think, well, you know, why should we kill our relatives just to have, to win the kingdom? As we can see Arjuna's reaction later on, which was what Dhritarashtra was hoping for, that maybe Arjuna and the Pandavas, they become favorably influenced for him, and they think, well, we don't want to kill anyone. We want to be nice. This is a holy place. You're not supposed to commit offenses at the holy place. But to speak of killing a few million people or a few hundred million people. So let us make a compromise and we'll go home. He was hoping like that. He asked the question, what did they do? Because when you have 640 million people assembled with their elephants and their chariots and their weapons and they're all enthusiastic, you know, what do you expect? What are they going to do? Sit down and play checkers? The only thing they came there for was fighting. It appears to be quite a strange question. But Sanjaya, knowing his mind, he begins to explain the Bhagavad Gita. So he says, Paishatam Panduputranam Achatisam. Sanjaya Vatra Drishvemam Swadhanam Krishna Yutsam Upat. Affectionate teacher and grandfather of the Pandavas. It was very difficult for them to fight against their beloved grandchild and teacher, grandchildren and teacher, students. So. Therefore, Duryodhana, he had to make a great effort in order to try to enthuse Dronacharya to engage in the battle. And he's trying to use different diplomatic techniques to do so. So the first thing he says is, just see this army that's been arranged by the son of Drupada. He doesn't say the name of Drupada, actually. He says Drupada Putrena, the son of Drupada. And he did it because when Drupada was younger, both Drupada and Dronacharya, they were both classmates in Gurukul. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas and sometimes the Vaishyas, they go to Gurukul. And in Gurukul, they were just friends. Even the Kshatriyas, their children would live very simply in the house of the Gurukul. There was no special treatment that he's a king, so he gets, you know, special arrangements. Everything was, in the Gurukul, everything is very simple. And in the Gurukul, they developed a very affectionate relationship, Drupada and Dronacharya. And one day in their affection, Drupada said, because you're my dear friend, therefore, Drupada said to Drona, I give you half my kingdom. But later on they grew up. Dronacharya became a very humble, advanced Brahmin. And Drupada became a great king. But one day, because he was so poor, Dronacharya, his son, Ashwatthama, came and said he wanted some milk. But his father, Dronacharya, was so poor he didn't have any cow, he had no milk. And his son, Ashwatthama, began to cry because all his friends were teasing him because they were so poor that never in his life Ashwatthama had any milk. He didn't even know what milk was. Dronacharya decided that let me go and beg a cow for my friend, King Drupada. He went all the way to the kingdom of Drupada and said, my dear Drupada, I've come here. He had an audience with Drupada and said, because we were friends one time, therefore you promised me half your kingdom. So Drupada was very proud. He said, friends? I'm a king and you're a very poverty-stricken beggar. How can we be friends? Only equals can be friends. So in Drona, I guess he didn't even ask for a cow. He became so disturbed, he just left. And he became determined that I'm going to take half his kingdom. So he immediately left, and he went to the kingdom of the Kurus. And there he met with Bhishma Dev, who was anxious to get a teacher, an acharya, for the Kuru warriors, the sons of Dhritarashtra and the Pandavas. So he hired Dronacharya to teach them, and then he taught the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra and the 5 Pandavas in the art of the military art. And then, after they were trained up in the military art, then he called them together one day and said, I would like some dakshin. And they said, what dakshin do you want? I want Drupada. Just give me one Drupada. They said, yes, we'll go and get him. But he said, no, only Arjuna will be able to do it. Because Drupada is so powerful, he'll be able to defeat all of you, but he won't be able to defeat Arjuna. So Arjuna went single-handedly, practically speaking, and defeated Drupada's army and also brought Drupada back and placed him at the feet of his guru. So Drupada, he was at the feet of Dronacharya, but Dronacharya said, my dear King Drupada, I will not take your kingdom, I will only take half your kingdom. You can have half of it. So Drupada smiled and looked forward to the day when he could get even. Said, thank you very much. And went back to his kingdom and began to perform a sacrifice to appease Lord Shiva so he can get a son who would kill Dronacharya. So he performed the sacrifice. Out of the sacrifice came Drishtadyumna and Draupadi. Drishtadyumna was born with all his weapons and Drupada was very happy. And it was announced at the time of Draupadi's manifestation from the fire that she was manifesting to destroy all the Kshatriyas. As they say, heavy lady. So this was the auspicious personality, Drishtadyumna, and he was meant to kill Dronacharya. But because Dronacharya was so expert at the military science, Drupada sent his son Drishtadyumna to be trained up by Dronacharya. And Dronacharya knew that this boy, he's manifested from the sacrifice just to kill me. But because he was a liberal Brahmin, he didn't hesitate to immediately train him up in the military science. There were means by which he would be killed. He didn't hesitate to deliver that means, that knowledge. The Brahmins were so liberal. Nowadays, if you want any knowledge, you have to pay $10,000 tuition. You have to, you know, fall at the feet of the teacher. And unless you have your tuition and your knowledge, you have to pass so many different tests, whatever. But, and all the knowledge that they have is useless anyhow. But here, even knowledge that's so powerful that it can even kill one's teacher, the Brahmin, wouldn't hesitate to deliver to a qualified person such as Drishtadyumna. So, Dronacharya, here we find Duryodhana specifically pointing out, just see, in the army over there, there is Drishtadyumna, the very person who's been born to kill you, he's the one who's arranged the whole military phalanx. This is all arrangement for your death. So get fired up. Don't space out. To use some colloquial terms. Because he was worried that Jupiter was a little weak-hearted. Dronacharya may have been a little weak-hearted because he was affectionate towards the Pandavas. Then he says, text 4, Atra sura maheshvasya bhimarjana samayudhi Yudana viratascha drupadascha maharata. Here in this army are many heroic bowmen equal in fighting to Bhima and Arjuna, great fighters like Yudana, Virata, and Drupada. The first person he points out is Bhima, because Duryodhana is especially afraid of Bhima. Bhima had taken 3 vows. The first vow was that he was personally going to kill all 100 sons of Dhritarashtra. And since Duryodhana happened to be one of them, he was a little nervous. Because Bhima was so fire, he was so enthusiastic to fulfill these vows. The second vow he had taken was he was going to wash Draupadi's hair with the blood of Dushasana. And he was personally going to drink Dushasana's blood. And the third vow was that he was going to smash the thigh. He was going to kill, actually smash the thigh of Duryodhana. These are all because of the gambling match. At the gambling match, first time the Pandavas, they lost. At that time, one of their objects that they wagered was their wife. They got down, they lost everything. Their helmets, practically the only thing they had left was their clothes. And they had their wife. So Shukini was the one who was he was throwing dice. And they said, well, you have one thing left, your wife. So you waited and you threw the dice and you lost your wife. Therefore, Dushasana was told, go into the lady's chambers and bring Draupadi, that she's been lost. She's a slave of the Kauravas now. So she didn't want to come, so Dushasana dragged her by the hair. And of course, then he tried to strip her naked. And Bhima, he was furious. He was burning with anger. And after he vowed, he was going to wash Draupadi's hair with the blood of Dushasana. And he was personally going to drink the blood. And indeed, during the battle, he finally met up with Dushasana. And he, right on the battlefield, he killed him. And then he took his, actually he didn't kill him. First what he did is he put his foot against his side, and then he took his arm and yanked his arm out of the socket. Then he lifted up Dushyasan while he was alive and drank his blood right on the battlefield. And the whole battlefield stopped. Just they couldn't believe it. Just watching. They thought Bhima was a little crazy. Bhima was so furious. He actually, one by one, he killed each one of the sons of Dhritarashtra. One after another. And finally, the last son, of course, Duryodhana, he took his club. Because Duryodhana, his mother, Gandhari, she was so austere that she had mystic power. When she was married to Dhritarashtra, in order to be equal to her husband, not to be above her husband, she took bandages and she had them wrapped around her eyes. So she voluntarily took the position of blindness. But because she was so chaste, she became very powerful. And right before the battle, she decided that, let me see my son naked, and then if I simply glance at him, his body will become invulnerable. She asked Duryodhana, come before me and don't wear anything. And this way I'll glance at you and your whole body will become invulnerable. Nothing will be able to touch your body. So Duryodhana said, all right. So he's about to come before his mother naked, and Krishna said, aren't you embarrassed? You should at least wear a gamsha, some, you know, loincloth or something. So he said, all right, nice. So he put on a loincloth, and the Gandhari, she took off her bandages and she glanced at Duryodhana, and his whole body, except for the part covered by the loincloth, became invulnerable. And then when she saw, oh, Krishna, he's the one who did this. So then she cursed that the dynasty of the Yadus would be destroyed. So 32 years later, it was destroyed. That same thigh that was covered by the cloth when Mother Gandhari glanced at it, that same thigh, Bhima, Krishna told him, if you want, now's the time, during the very end of the battle, and everyone practically was killed. It was just Duryodhana and Bhima in the Pandavas left. Then Bhima and Duryodhana, they fought with each other club on club, because Bhima was more powerful than Duryodhana. But Duryodhana had learned the art of club fighting from a good teacher, Balaram, God himself. So he was quite good at it. And so they fought, and neither one of them could defeat each other. So Bhima said to Krishna, he said, I can't defeat him. So Krishna empowered him and said, you know, remember the thigh? Thigh. Think of thigh. So then Bhima remembered, I'm going to smash his thigh. He walked over and smashed his thigh, the only part that was vulnerable. And Duryodhana fell down, and later he died. Therefore, he was a little nervous when he saw Bhima. And he had good reason to be nervous. And then he compares Arjuna, because Arjuna is so powerful, and these other warriors. And then the next verses. Text 5. Dristaketu Shekitana Kasiraja Suviryavan Puruja Kunti Bojascha Saivascha Narapungavaha. There are also great heroic powerful fighters like Dristaketu, Chaikitana, Kasi Rajas, Purujit, Kunti Bojas, and Shaivya. Text 6. Yudamanus Chavikranta, Utamojas Chaviryavant, Sovadro Dropadeyastra, Sarveva Maharata. They are the mighty Yudamanu, the very powerful Utamoja, the son of Subhadra, and the sons of Draupadi. All these warriors are great chariot fighters. Duryodhana's beginning, he's naming all the superstars on the other side. So this doesn't sound like it's very diplomatic. But he's just trying to encourage Dronacharya that he has to understand it's not so simple as he thought it was going to be. Duryodhana thought that I'm not even going to give them enough land to drive a needle into, that they can't possibly get together any soldiers after being exiled for 13 years or 14 years. But he's surprised, 7 Akshahini divisions. Therefore, he names the great warriors, and then he says, now, pay attention. Text number 7. Ashvakam tu vishistaye tani bodha dvijotama nayakamama sanyasya samgetam tambravimite. But for your information, O best of the Brahmins, let me tell you about the captains who are specially qualified to lead my military force. So here he uses the word my military, mama sannyasya, as if all these warriors out there, they're all belonging to me. There's a false ego problem. So find out. He thinks that everyone belongs to him. First he thought the whole world belonged to him, now he thinks also all these soldiers. But now he has a problem, because he's going to start pointing out the different soldiers. So in text 8, now who should he point out first? At this time, Duryodhana, he's speaking to Dronacharya, but all the great warriors have all gathered around to listen, because the king himself is about to speak. So Bhishma is there, and Ashwatthama is there, and Bhurishrava is there. So many different great warriors are there. So who is he going to point out first? If he points out Bhishma first, then Duryodhana will be insulted. Oh, he doesn't think I'm very important just because I'm a Brahmin, etc. And if he points out Duryodhana first, then maybe Bhishma will be disappointed that he doesn't know who I am. I'm the grandfather. I could have been the king, and now he doesn't take me very serious. I'm the person who hired him. I am the one who brought him into this whole thing in the first place, Dronacharya. So he doesn't know who should he present first. But he thought, if I present Dronacharya first, because he's a Brahmin, then Bhishma, he won't be annoyed. He won't be disappointed, because he's a Kshatriya, and the Kshatriyas naturally respect the Brahmins. So he says, Bhavan Bhimash Chakarnas Cha. So then he first points out, Bhavan, that you're a good self. Dronacharya is pointed out by Duryodhana. And then he says, Bhishma. But then he says, Chakarnas Cha. He mentions Karna. So Karna, he was the son of who? And who is his father? What's that? Vivishvan, the sun god. He was one of the members of the Pandavas. He was one of their brothers. But because of the situation, Kunti Devi had put Karna in a little boat and sailed him down the river. But Karna, everyone thought he was simply a chariot driver, Adirath, son of a chariot driver. But Karna had a very great enmity towards Bhishma Dev. So he refused to fight. As long as this old grandfather is living, that I won't fight. Because if I fight and I kill all these warriors on the other on the other side, then Bhishma Dev, he's going to get all the credit. Because Bhishma, he led the army in the first part of the battle. So he said, I won't fight as long as he's alive. Therefore, in order to encourage Dronacharya, he points out, next he mentions Karna. And then he says, to Karna's cha. Of course, he's trying to encourage Karna, but he's not even going to fight at this point. Then he says, Kripa. So Kripa, he's the son, he's the brother-in-law of Dronacharya. His sister is Kripi, and Kripi married Dronacharya. So again, he's really trying to enthuse Dronacharya by pointing out Karna and his brother-in-law. And then he says, Ashvatthama. Ashvatthama is his son. This is really an attempt to make Dronacharya enthusiastic. pointing out all these different personalities. And then he points out Vikarna. So Vikarna, he was one of the 100 brothers, or 99 brothers, of Duryodhana. He was not at all a great warrior, but during the gambling matches, he was the only one who protested that why are you taking the Pandava's kingdom, etc., etc. He began to protest, and so it was. They were afraid that perhaps Vikarna would go on to the other side, because it was a custom before a battle, a big battle, that the king would stand up and they say, if anyone would like to come on our side, you can come on our side and fight. The warriors, their wars were just like a big football game. It wasn't like the war in Vietnam or something where people would, you know, spend the whole time in the foxhole smoking marijuana, trying to, you know, keep out of sight from the enemy. But they took it as a great sporting event, and they loved to fight. Even Karna, Krishna came to him right before the battle and said, you know, Karna, I don't know if you know it or not, but your real father and mother are Kunti Devi and Vibhishan. That's why you're always worshipping the sun god. That's why Kunti always cries when she sees you. So why don't you do this? Since you made a pledge not to fight, why don't you fight on the side of the Pandavas? Because you're actually one of the Pandavas, one of your brothers. And when Bhishma dies, then you can join the other side and fight. So they were not at all attached to which side they were going to fight on. They just liked to fight. They were afraid that Vikarna would just defect, go on the other side and fight. Therefore, he points out, and also Vikarna. Of course, when Yudhisthira stands up and says, if anyone would like to join our party, then let them come. So Vikarna did come and join the party on that side. So this is the Kshatriya spirit. I think I'll stop there. And tomorrow we'll go a little bit more. We'll go into more of the first chapter. Hopefully by the end of this, we'll be able to come up to the fourth chapter at least. So thank you very much. Grantharai Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Premanande.